Hi, everyone. This is Cliff, your host of Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. It is Saturday. It's June 14th, and I'm calling from or broadcasting from Oakland, California, and it's beautiful today. I hope it's nice where you are, too. This is a great week for me. I am thinking more about upcoming trips. I'm hoping to get to Lima, Peru this August and do some research with Jesus Gamarra, the son of Alberto Gamarra, who is the scientist who basically came up with the three phases, the three worlds, as he calls them, for the rock formations in Peru. And this week, I posted on my Facebook page some other research. An archaeologist named Bill Veal, William Veal, he's from British Columbia. He has actually produced a book. It's an e-book where he has revealed that the Nazca lines, in certain areas of the Nazca lines, have encrypted code, and I posted it. He actually has a verification from two other scientists in Europe that there is a 3rd century Phoenician text in one of the Nazca line complexes, and I've posted it, and it just completely blew me away when I read this, and I have seen his part of his book. He's sending me the rest of it. It's available right now as an iBook, which means that if you have an Apple computer, you can download the book, but you can't see it in a PC or there's no other format. And he's trying to rectify that and make it available to more of a wider audience. I'm going to be posting some more information about his book, but he has done something that I have discovered about 3 years ago, which is using satellite imagery on the surface of various ancient sites. And what he discovered, which is I actually discovered it about 4 years ago, but he discovered it around the same time, which is fascinating, and you've talked about it a few times, is that there are massive forms, symbols, and figures that are cut into the surface of various parts of Peru. And one of his sections in his book has a number of these amazing, beautifully sculpted heads, the reliefs cut into the ground. And I'm going to be posting those up probably in the next day or two. So stay tuned for that. So that is a fantastic discovery. And it kind of leads me into our guest today and ancient civilizations around the world. Today's guest is Frank Joseph, and Frank is a prolific author. He has written numerous books on Atlantis, but this current book, Before Atlantis, 20 million years of human history, 20 million years of human and pre-human culture, is quite an amazing look at Earth, thousands and thousands of years before our written history. And let me just tell you a little bit about him. Frank Joseph was the editor-in-chief of Ancient American Magazine from 1993 until 2009. He's the author of several books, including Atlantis and 2012 and Advanced Civilizations of Prehistoric America. But he's also written quite a few other books, and he's written The Destruction of Atlantis, The Lost Civilizations of Lemuria, Survivors of Atlantis, Seven Secrets of Time Travel, and it goes on and on. He's a prolific writer. I kind of want to ask him as a writer myself how he gets the time to do this, but I'm going to bring him on now. Hi, Frank. Can you hear me?
Hi, Cliff. It's great to be here.
Yes, thanks for joining us today. This new book, I've had a chance to look at it. I haven't read it in any depth, but It's a good, solid take on prehistory. And tell me about it. Tell me about why a book on before Atlantis. My understanding is Atlantis is extremely old as in its own right. But what is the take on this book? That's the first question I have for you today.
Okay, I had several questions I wanted to have answered. And when I begin writing a book, I know very little about what I'm going to write about. It's a process of discovery while I write, and I hope to include some of that for the reader. So it's a co-creative process for both myself and for the reader. We both try to discover the answers to some questions that we're interested in. And the question I was particularly interested in is, where did we come from? How did we originate? How and why are we the only animals on the face of the earth that have made civilization? There are other animals that are at least as intelligent as us, probably more intelligent than us. I'm referring to the dolphin, for example, and the humpback whale. Recent studies have shown that their intellectual capacities are just outstanding. It's just amazing what they're learning about the cetaceans. Mm. And I wanted to find out, well, what is it that made us so different? Not necessarily the best or even so special, but what made us so different? Why do we? The other question is after we make civilization, and it's hard. It takes sometimes thousands of years to make a civilization, and then they're great, they flourish, and they always fail. They always collapse. Well, why is that? So those are some of the questions that I wanted to have answered. I figured that the answers to these questions lie in their origins. You just don't start from the end where we are now and work backwards. You go back to the origins and try to figure out what is it, what pattern did we set so long ago that created what we're doing now? And that's basically the questions that I wanted to have answered. And as far as Atlantis is concerned, why I chose that term before Atlantis is because Atlantis was the first modern civilization. It wasn't the first civilization. There were civilizations before Atlantis, high cultures. Mm-hmm. Civilization is a kind of a difficult thing to define now. It used to be very well understood, but now with all the we're awash in political correctness now, so the most backward tribe in the Congo is referred to as a civilization. So we don't really even know anymore what a civilization is, but we can just basically say we know what it is. It's a more organized society rather than just a hunter-gatherer society and a high culture. But Atlantis was the first modern one in the sense that it was very much like ours. It had an economy. It had weights and measures system. It had organized trade, had the arts, institutionalized religion, and it was run by a greedy elite. So it's really just basically the same as we are now. It's only just an earlier inflection of it.
Yeah.
And so I think, like, okay, well, that's the first modern one. So we have to go kind of before that. I mean, what caused that pattern that we have been stuck in as a species for thousands of years now? And that's what I wanted to have answered. That's what I looked at. How did we start? What makes us so different? And I went way, way back and found some really interesting things. This book was written before Atlantis was written to a large extent on material I got from the Internet. And the reason why, it sounds rather, you know, flimsy and frivolous, but the Internet is, of course, an information highway, and it's also, of course, an information sewer. So you have to be discerning enough to tell the dross from the valuable parts that are.
Okay. You have to wade through the muck to get to the gold, is what you're saying.
Well, I try not to do too much wading. I try to avoid it and sidestep it as much as possible, keep as clean as possible. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but there's also a lot of nonsense out there. Well, that's all this is fine. Because that's what the human mind is. It's filled with a lot of high concepts and filled with a lot of low concepts. But the what I'm referring to especially is I went on to the university and the science websites and blogs. And the reason why I did that was because there is a phenomenal amount of scientific progress that is being made today. The amount of scientific progress being made right now is greater than at any time in history. And it is there's so much. And it's happening so fast, and the changes are so rapid that it's almost impossible to keep abreast of it. So what I wanted to do was to bring some of these really earth-shaking discoveries that are being made and not really recognized very much, especially because Our news media is more concerned about the massacre of the week or the massacre of the day now, whatever it is, and trivia and, you know, what's happening in the Ukraine and all this. I guess these things are important, but, you know, scientific truths that are being arrived at that are totally rewriting our concept of who we are and the world we live in, these are mostly ignored. They're not really discussed. And so the internet opened up all this great information, and that's what I put into the book. But I just didn't jam it with information. I just didn't want to do that. I tried to sort it out, make sense of it, and make a picture of it, and it's really pretty astounding. It's amazing. I mean, our whole concept of the way that we've evolved as a species now is altering. It's just remarkable.
Right. I want to jump into the book in a minute, but I have not had a chance to talk to you, and you have a tremendous amount of focus on Atlantis. So I want to ask you a couple of quick questions regarding Atlantis. How old do you say, now, from Casey, who was a seer, from Plato, and from some scattered information, my understanding is that Atlantis was in three phases, a very early phase, hundreds of thousands, and then there were two subsequent phases, and then the final phase was a destruction when Atlantis was a series of islands. Now, how far back do you show, or what does your research show on how old Atlantis was?
Well, I think that's really good of you to look at Atlantis in three major phases like that. That certainly is a legitimate way of looking at it. And those three phases would be its origins way, way back in time, its first phase, second phase was when it flourished into this magnificent civilization, high technology and beautiful culture, and then the third phase where it went into a power freak sort of a stage and declined into self-indulgence and ended in destruction. So that's definitely a correct way. That's the question, though, that you're asking is how old was Atlantis is something that I tried to tackle in the book, and for the first time, because I didn't know either. I have written more books on Atlantis than anybody else in history. That doesn't necessarily mean they're the best book on Atlantis, but there's more than anybody else has ever written. So I've been obsessed with this subject since about 1980 when I first really began. When I first heard of Atlantis, I don't know. But I always regarded it as kind of an interesting myth until I started reading some of the source materials and I began traveling around the world. And it took me at least 2 or 3 years before I realized that Atlantis was a real place and had tremendous significance for what we are now. How old is Atlantis? I think what Atlantis was this. The concept of Atlantis as a continent, as it's described as a continent, is a mistake. It's a legitimate mistake, because it was a huge enterprise. It was an empire, for God's sake, and it ruled like half the world. It was a world culture, but it was a culture kind of like the Japanese Empire in World War II or just before. The Japanese controlled this vast empire across the Pacific and Asia from their islands in Japan, and that's pretty much what Atlantis was. It controlled this incredibly huge imperial enterprise from their islands in the Atlantic. And long before that, this people settled on an island which no longer exists above the surface of the sea, although it exists below the surface of the sea, on this large island. This is referred to by oceanographers as the Horseshoe Seamount. This is a large circular island surrounded by mountains, and it really exists. It's been found and known by oceanographers for well over 100 years. It needs to be explored, though. In any case, this large island had a peninsula or a land bridge, several actually, some connected to North Africa, others to southwestern Europe. And it's over this land bridge that early animals like the mastodons crossed, and mastodon bones have been found in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean when they crossed over. Back in the early 1960s, the Swedes conducted some early dredgings on the seafloor right in this area, the Horseshoe Seamount, and they found literally thousands of elephant bones, thousands, at 40 different sites in the Horseshoe Seamount. This is 265 miles west of the Straits of Gibraltar.
I was just going to ask you where it is. So it's off Spain, right?
Yes,
somewhere off
between,
of Spain.
If you had a line drawn straight of Gibraltar, and it would vector north, east to Portugal, and southeast to Morocco, and draw that out about 265 miles, that's where Atlantis was and is actually still. And so over these land bridges that these animals and early human beings crossed. So we can say that the habitation of this island, long before it was known as Atlantis or anything, but this island in the Atlantic Ocean, these human beings followed these migrating herds of animals that they hunted. This is very early, like proto-human beings. These are like Homo erectus and hardly more advanced than that. We're talking a very long time ago, you know, well over a million years ago. And we do know that early men were on the march, that they did travel great distances. And they traveled across this land bridge, this peninsula, to what is the Atlantic Ocean. And over time, when the ice ages melted, the ice age was such that it locked up huge amounts of water. It just sucked up gigantic amounts of water in this freeze that took place. And then when the ice ages melted, all this water was released. And the sea levels at that time, we're talking now about 10 or 12,000 years ago, were almost 400 feet lower than they are today. So there's a sea level rise, an incredible sea level rise. This is all mainstream history, by the way. I'm not channeling this or making this up. This is now established consensus geography and geology and oceanography, that sea levels rose almost 400 feet at the end of the last ice age. Not all at once, but in surges, so you had some pretty major floods going on. And these land bridges that connected this Atlantic island to Europe and Africa, they went underwater. They got submerged. And the island was above water for really quite a few years, quite a thousands of years after that. And these populations of animals and human beings were stranded on this island. The island turned to be out to be a really fruitful place. It was volcanic, so it had a very rich, fertile soil. It was in a temperate climate zone, so you had two growing seasons. And over time, these human beings evolved, over a very long time, they evolved a very high culture. And I believe it's the first culture, the first human culture, which was located on this island, that later became...
So give us a rough time frame for the first Atlanteans. What's the rough time?
Well, I would say that the first Atlanteans, if you want to call them that, or the very first people that went across this land bridge, had to be like maybe 500,000 years ago. And they were a very low level of culture, if you'd even call it that. Say they were just hunter-gatherers. However, as time went on and they evolved over the generations, we can jump much further now into the future. And there's indications that the first high culture that arose on Atlantis, and actually anywhere in the world, took place about 4,500 BC. I hesitate a little bit because we don't know the exact date. There's no way to know the exact date.
Okay.
But the reason why we mentioned that time, 4,500 BC, is because at the same time that Atlantis is becoming something of a culture, you begin to see the growth of these megalithic cultures on the shores of Atlantic Europe, Western Europe. And the megalithic cultures, these were tremendous proto-civilizations. If they weren't civilizations all forthright, they were the arrangement of gigantic stones that weighed numerous tons with precise alignments to earth energies and sky energies. What I mean by that is that the stones were aligned like Stonehenge. That's the most famous of them all, by no means the earliest or even the most incredible, just the most famous. But Stonehenge is an arrangement of these multi-ton blocks of granite with such precision to various star formations and star clusters and solstices and vernal equinoxes, that you have, in effect, a computer that was made 5,000 and 6,000 years ago that is still working. I mean, what will we create now that's going to be still working 6,000 years from now? And that's what these magnificent megalithic structures, and there are tens of thousands, not hundreds or thousands, but tens of thousands of these fabulous monuments all across Europe, into the Atlantic Ocean, across North Africa, into Asia, across the United States, literally around the world. And these megalithic masterpieces by the tens of thousands are evidence, physical evidence, for a global culture, a world civilization that arose by 4000 BC. And all evidence, and I've tried to present it in my book as carefully as I can, all evidence seems to show that it radiated outward from this Atlantic source. And it's an incredible story, but I mean, it's not something that one makes up. You can go and visit these magnificent structures, and they all have basically the same alignments. That's the incredible thing. Whether you can find a so-called medicine wheel in Wyoming or Stonehenge itself, they all are oriented to specific phases of the moon, the solstices, and the equinoxes.
So this technology, you feel, is radiates out from Atlantis. And so
yes,
it's kind of a universal knowledge on how to erect these observatories. And then, obviously, there must be some technology where the stones are imbued with some information, or they're set up in such a way that the locals were educated, and then they were they began using these stone megaliths.
Well, I think you're right on track. That is exactly. Now we have to understand, why is it that they would go to such enormous trouble to create these multi-ton blocks, shape them in such a specific way, and then set them up with precise alignments to the stars? One example of that I have to cite, even more incredible than Stonehenge, which is amazing in itself, of course, is a place called Ergrah, E-R-G-R-A-H, and it's not as well known, and it should be. This is on the coast of the Atlantic coast of France in Brittany. And this stone originally was almost 70 feet high. It weighed something like about 60 tons, and it's shaped like an enormous needle. It can be seen from more than 12 miles out at sea, so it was used as a kind of a marker. But most importantly, this huge, unbelievable, gigantic stone was oriented to a specific orientation of the moon called the metonic cycle. I'm not going to go into that in detail because it'll waste a lot of time, but I mention that because it shows the tremendous precision involved. This stone fell over in an earthquake only about 300 years ago. It's broken into three pieces, but you can still visit it. The reason why these stones were set up was because of their common manufacture. What I mean by that is these stones are all made of granite. The vast majority of these stones are made of granite, and virtually all of them have large flecks of crystal, quartz crystal in them. The other commonality is that these great stones made of quartz crystal are set upon seismic zones. They are specifically made over earthquake faults. A place in Carnac, also in Brittany in western France, has something like about 3,000 to 4,000 stones in place. Each one of them were inserted specifically into an earthquake zone, a fault zone. And when you find that this is a commonality found around the world, that these megaliths were made of quartz crystal, granite mostly, they were set up into earthquake zones, earthquake tectonically active areas, then you have to wonder, well, what is the relationship between quartz crystal and an earthquake? Why would anybody go to that kind of trouble? And that's because quartz crystal has an electronic quality called piezoelectricity. It's like the old crystal radio sets. When you turned on a crystal radio set, when you turn that dial, what it did is it caused a little vise inside the radio to squeeze the quartz crystal. And when the crystal got squeezed, it emitted an electrical spark that turned the radio on. That's called piezoelectricity. Now, if you've got a a huge collection of quartz crystal in a seismically active zone. It gets squeezed and it creates piezoelectricity. That piezoelectricity creates a sort of a nimbus, a bluish electronic nimbus, a haze. So it looks very mystical. But it's not just a magical effect. It creates an interface with the human brain. It's known as negative ion therapy today. Negative ion therapy has been used in hospitals for the past 20 years or so. And it's used on patients who are resistant to normal forms of anesthesia. And that's because negative ion therapy puts them into a relaxed state. Sometimes they actually pass out. If you're standing next to, like, Stonehenge or one of these other major megalithic sites, at a time when the tectonic energy is squeezing those quartz crystals, you will be affected by this burst of negative ion energy. And it creates euphoria. It creates a feeling of oneness. And sometimes people experience the presence of angels or gods and so forth. And that is the reason why these megalithic sites were set up around the world. They were set up by a religious community who were able to install these great megalithic structures as places where you could go and undergo a mystical experience. So it is a religion. It is a kind of a spiritual fraternity that went around the world and created this global religious idea. And I believe that that was the original religion of Atlantis, which was to have a mystical experience.
You know, it's interesting.
A few words, but
yeah, that is. And it's fascinating what you've discovered. But it's funny because the whole theory of the ley lines and this global grid, it's hard to prove based on our current technology, but I think our technology is growing. Have you read the book by John Burke called Seeds of Knowledge, Stones of Plenty, where he actually takes electronic sensing devices and measures the emissions from various megaliths around the world?
No, I haven't, but I'd love to. That sounds great. There have been others who have done work like that, like Robert Devereaux, for example. He's done some fabulous work with that. There was the Dragon Project back in the 1970s and 80s that had electronic measurements of these stones. And I would like to read this gentleman's book, certainly, to keep an update. But what I'm discussing here is not theory. This has been demonstrated numerous times that these granite stones, these ancient stones that were set up in to resemble tables or needles and so forth, that they do, in fact, emanate not only electronic transmissions, as it were, but most importantly, they create these negative ions, which interface with the biocircuitry or the bioelectrical base of the human brain, and it gives you an altered state of consciousness. So based on this proved information, this is not theoretical, this is not channeled information, it's demonstrable information. We know that these great stones were set up in seismically active areas specifically, and we do know that these stones react to tectonic forces in such a way as to create these negative ions. So we can deduce logically that they were set up by a religious community, a spiritual community, and that the core belief of this spiritual community was the mystical experience. You can have all kinds of theology. You can read about all these things about the gods and the saints. But unless you've actually had a mystical experience, personal experience of your own, there it's meaningless. And that's the basis of this old religion, which was highly advanced. The religion is a reflection of the high sophistication of this culture that flourished 4,000 and 6,000 years ago. It's amazing. And I think that everything points to its origin in Atlantis. And so that helps to answer the first question, where did we come from? How did we create this civilization? And I think that's where it goes back to.
Well, before we jump into the book, let me just ask you one last question based on your research of these megaliths. Is it your understanding, and it seems to be one of mine in my research, it's your understanding that the prehistoric people had an understanding of earth energy, unlike we understand today. I mean, we're more of a technology-based society where we rely on machines to tell us things. What is your feeling about that?
Well, I believe 100% correct that, with you that our ancestors had a very deep and thorough grasp of Earth energies. And you can look at some of Native peoples today who understand that. I'm referring specifically to the Wasatch Indians of Utah and the Wasatch Mountains. The reason I mention them is because the Wasatch Indians in that area, the shamans, what they do at specific times of the year is that they go up into the mountains, in the Wasatch Mountains, and they look for, they hunt for specific types of little crystals, and the mountains are filled with them up there. These are common quartz crystals, and they collect certain ones which are very clear. And they make a little collection. They do this every year. These are not rare gems or anything, but they're I guess, more infrequently encountered. So they will collect these little quartz crystals, and they will put them into a bag, a special bag which is sewn for them. And the bag is very filmy. It holds together, but you can almost see through. It's almost transparent. And then during their ceremonies at this time of the year, which, by the way, is at the vernal equinox or the first day of spring around that time, the Wasatch Indians, then they have these dances, these ritual dances that the shamans put on. They've been doing this for time out of mind. They still do it. And during the dances are at night, and there is no illumination whatsoever. They have a kind of an arena, a people's arena that they go to, and they put on these dances to bring in the new light of spring. And they shake these bags filled with these quartz crystals, and the quartz crystals bang against each other. They clack against each other, creating that piezoelectric effect that I mentioned, and they spark. So here is a dancer. He's dancing in the dark. You can barely make him out, and he's shaking this bag, and there are these sparks flying through out of this bag because of the quartz crystals. This indicates a relatively primitive people, certainly not a materially advanced people, who nonetheless have a fundamental grasp of Earth energies, which they're actually applying in a ritual context. So I think that this is a slight indication of a more highly advanced society like the Atlanteans had, who had a direct application of Earth energies. And to answer your question, to go back, I'll just mention this very briefly again. It was their knowledge of these Earth energies and how they affect human consciousness, how they affect the human subconscious to create this mystical experience that was really the origin of religion. When you see that you could interface so much with these energies that it would affect you in an altered state of consciousness, this, I think, was the beginning of religion. And they oriented them to things like the stars and so forth because they honored both the forces on the cosmos and the forces in the earth, Mother Earth and Father Sky. We are a creation of both. We are the children of Father Sky and Mother Earth. And I think that that's when by having their alignment, say, with the solstices and other planets like the Pleiades, which they had a fixation on, it was to put human beings in accord, in harmony with the forces of nature. So the first religion was a religion that acknowledged the forces of nature and then tried to put human beings in accord with those forces of nature. That was the basis of the Atlantean religion.
Amazing. So just to recap what you just said, it sounds like you believe they had a piezoelectric science that was extremely sophisticated, and that was
I believe so.
What we always hear about. We always hear about
it. It was fundamentally simple, but when we say sophisticated, we think of the complexities of our mechanistic technology. That is not the way it began. I think that the application of these natural forces was fundamentally simple, but it's genius to recognize them and to harness them in such a way that they use them not for our purposes of, you know, lighting your house and making energy to charge more customers to make a more successful business. They weren't interested in any of that whatsoever. It was to develop the human soul and to put, more importantly, to put human beings as a society in accord with the laws of nature.
Amazing. Okay, well, that's thank you for that, Frank. That's I think we're going to have another show just on Atlantis, because that's amazing. Let's jump into the book. I want to talk about your view, your look into early human, and in an early chapter, you term a humanoid as Homo aquatus. And I want to tell us a little bit about that, because that's a fascinating subject that you researched.
It is, and that is, I guess, the prime reason why I started writing this, was to find out, even long before Atlantis. Of course, we've talked about Atlantis here and the development of society and religion, but where did we come from as a species? What makes us so different than any other species on Earth? We are closely related to the chimpanzees and the great apes. We have 98 chromosomes compared to their 95. There's a lot of you can look into the eyes and the face of a chimpanzee and see something of ourselves reflected into that, both good and ill. And yet there are some significant differences. And I wanted to find out, well, what is it that made us diverge from the other primates? And the basic story of evolution, of course, you're familiar with, that our ancestors about 4 or 6 million years ago, our primate ancestors lived in the treetops, and that seems to be correct. We lived in the treetops because living in the treetops was a great place to live. It had lots of fruit, a lot of free food. You were off the ground, so you didn't have to worry about the predators that were down there. And so for a long time, we lived in this blissful treetop paradise. Earth changed. There was massive drought that took place. The trees vanished. We were forced out of the trees onto the savanna. And now we're living amongst predators. And we suffered a lot, and we were faced with the similar question that Mother Nature asks every species in situations like this: adapt or die. So you have to have an adaptation or you're going to be wiped out. And we were now thrust into a very difficult survival mode. And our species adapted, and we became predators. We became very close-knit tribal groups. We needed that in order to survive. Individually, we couldn't survive. We had to depend on each other, and we created society. This is the basic premise for the beginnings of human evolution, and I believe that. I think that's exactly what happened. But now there's a difficulty. The difficulty is that our ancestors began to stand upright. And there's no advantage in that, or very little advantage in that. All the other primates, they can stand upright from time to time. They use that for threat displays. That's about all. Most of the time, they're down on all fours, which is a much better way to go around. If you stand up, you create enormous problems for your back, for your knees, and for all of your lower limbs, all your muscles and everything. All of our back problems stem basically from the fact that we have been standing upright all our lives. We're still not entirely used to that as a species. There's really very little advantage to that. You can fall down, a lot of difficulties. Why is it that we stood upright? And when we did stand upright, though, one of the things happened is the larynx in our throat moved downward. When that happened, that means that we could produce more sophisticated sounds. We could begin to talk. That's the reason why the chimpanzees and the great apes, they cannot talk. They never will be able to talk because the larynx is too high up in their throat. And the reason it's high up in their throat is because they're on all fours most of the time. When we stood up, that brought the larynx on. So two things distinguished us. We stood upright, which the other primates didn't do, and it's not a good idea. And we began to be able to vocalize. We could talk now. We could actually form words, which they can never do because our larynx went down. The other thing is that we got a tremendous boost in intelligence somehow. A phenomenal increase in intelligence. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that our teeth, which were much bigger, and nowhere near as big as the gorillas or the chimpanzees, now our teeth got a lot smaller. We still have canines like they have and molars, but we can't tear flesh. We can't tear through the hide of an animal like they can. And what changes are these? Why did we go through these changes? The changes were this. I'm not going to go into the whole background of it because it's very long. It takes a long time. We do know, scientists do know, that during this period when human beings began to stand upright, when their teeth got weaker, when their larynx began to sink deeper into their throat and they could cause sounds to be made, could begin the articulation of words, that all that happened at a time in Southeast Africa. And at that time, Southeast Africa went through major flooding. We're talking like about 2 million years ago. Probably a little more than 2 million years ago. Say 2 million and a quarter million years ago. Major flooding took place in Southeast Africa. We don't know why. It's part of the earth changes. And when this flooding took place, much of what is East Africa today was rendered into islands. And the water encroached rapidly on the territory of East Africa. It would appear that this is a hypothesis. Some might call it a theory. It's not proved, but it makes a great deal of sense. And I tried to bring as much reason and logic to it as I possibly can in the book. I did not invent this theory, but I subscribe to it entirely now. And that is the aquatic ape theory, or the aquatic ape hypothesis, as it's sometimes referred to. And that is that these populations of early primates, which were hardly more different than chimpanzees today, were isolated on these little islands by encroaching water, and that the water began to encroach more and more on these territories until these human or these proto-human populations were compromised, and they were faced with the same challenge that Mother Nature gave them earlier, and that is adapt or die, go extinct or make an adaptation. And they began to adapt to a marine existence, to a sea existence, more and more, until they went into the water. Our early ancestors were forced into the water, and they had to make an adaptation to it. And as they went into the water, they no longer walked on all fours, because if you go into the water, the center of gravity in your body pushes you upward, and you begin to now feel about on the bottom with your feet, and you use your arms and your hands to grasp and to swim. This is the same process that we're seeing today in Japanese macaques. These are these little monkeys that live in Sapporo, Japan, northern Japan, very cold area. They're surrounded by water, and they live in these hot springs, mostly in these hot springs. And they are among the few other primates that now begin to walk on their hind limbs, and they swim. Like most primates are horrified of water. In most zoos, you can create a difference between in an open area between the gorillas and the chimpanzees, who will otherwise fight and kill and eat each other. All you have to do is create a stream in between them, and they won't cross it because they're averse to water. The chimpanzees and the apes, they get their water from mostly from fruits they eat. They are mostly horrified of water. Our species is not. We love water. All our waterfront property is the most expensive, even to this day. We go to the beaches and so forth. So what happened was is that our ancestors made an adjustment to the water. And when we began to stand upright, our larynx went lower into our throat. We could make vocalized sounds. We began, the food that was available to us now was shellfish and fish. So our teeth no longer had to become the great mandibles that are used for tearing flesh and so forth. They got smaller and smaller. And then the sea retreated, and we found ourselves back on the land again. Only now we had some sea mammal characteristics, and we became a hybrid. That this process of going into the water and out of the water took place several times. We went through several aquatic phases where we had to adapt to a marine existence, and then we're stranded back on the land again. And that is what we are. We are a hybrid. We are part flipper, and we are part killer chimpanzee. That explains our human nature. The human being is capable of great compassion. We create hospitals to care for our fellow human beings. We feel empathy for our fellow human beings. Our technology has enabled us to do godlike things, to send the Hubble spacecraft out, our medicine, wonderful things. We are also the same species that and the same technology that created the hydrogen bomb and the atom bomb. Not only did we create the atom bomb, we actually had the gall to drop not one, but two atomic bombs on our fellow human beings, regardless of the military or the political implications. People want to argue what happened at Nagasaki or Hiroshima. Nonetheless, that's what we did. That's what we do. We are mass murderers. We produce the Dalai Lama, and we also produce, Joseph Stalin. We are the cruelest animal on the face of the earth. And we are also the most compassionate. So we are a hybrid mix of both the aquatic ape, and we are also part of the chimpanzee. And the chimpanzee lives in a tribal society, and in this tribal society regards every other chimpanzee outside the tribal society as an enemy to be opposed or sometimes eaten. And then within the tribal society, there is no equality whatsoever. Inside the chimpanzee society, there is class stratification, there is a hierarchy, and you find the same thing in human society throughout time and including our own time. You find these class stratifications, these differences. Now, if you go to other societies like the dolphin society, you find something completely different. And the dolphin is not a fish. The dolphin is a mammal like ourselves. The dolphin went through the same challenge that its ancestors did, which was adapt or die. Because in Southeast Africa, we were not the only species that were challenged in this way. The other mammals had to either adapt to an aquatic existence or else die on land. Some of them returned to the land like we did, and we became human beings. Other mammals, like proto-wolves and proto-dogs, they went into the sea, and they evolved over the course of many millions of years into the dolphins. We now know that's what happened, that the dolphin was a mammal that went into the sea and adapted entirely to a mammal existence. Other animals, like us, and also like the elephant, the ancestor of the elephant was also exclusively a land mammal. It was challenged by the sea, went into the sea, became a mammal, found itself stranded back on the land again, and then began to readapt to a terrestrial existence. It's the same as we did. That is now known about the elephant. And other animals, other mammals went through this. But how some mammals, though, chose to continue their evolution as sea mammals. And that's what became with the dolphins. Mm-hmm. The dolphin society is not noted for its tribalism. It's noted for its compassion. It's not noted for its aggression. It's noted for its cooperativeness and for its friendliness towards man. Mm-hmm. And
so the aquatic man, as you call him, or Aquidius, what remains of him in us? Are you saying it's the compassionate side, or is there some part in our body that that you think or you have discovered is left from the time we were in the sea?
There are numerous vestigial traits that we have from our sea interlude, and that these traits are not found in any other primates at all. Mm. And that we'll start with something really simple that anybody can find. Look at your hand, and you will see a flap of skin from your thumb to your forefinger. This is the remnant of a web. You actually can see it between your other fingers, the remnants of webbing that is not found in any of the other primates. There is a condition known as syndactyly. And in syndactyly, there are some infants that are born, human infants that are born with pronounced webbing between their fingers and toes. It amounts to about 7% of all male children who have syndactyly and 9% of females that have syndactyly. Some famous examples of people who had webbing, pronounced webbing between their fingers and toes, were Stalin, that I mentioned him. He had webbing, and also Dan Aykroyd. He also has pronounced webbing or syndactyly. You do not find this webbing amongst any other primates. There's a long list of characteristics. The most outstanding that I can think of is our own birth. When a human being is born, you may have been familiar with this. Our listeners may be familiar with this that I'm going to describe as a variation of birth called the water babies. These are human beings now, this happens now, but it was more popular, I guess, about 20 years ago, that women would give birth to their children in water. And when the child was born, this is an amazing thing that you can go on YouTube and see numerous versions of this. When the child is born, it immediately begins to swim. This is an infant who is born with an instinct to swim. I have literally dozens of photographs, which anybody can obtain off the internet, and you can go on YouTube and see this. These brand new infants are swimming with their eyes open. They know how to hold their breaths. They come to the surface, and they take their first gulp of cold air, and then they swim. A chimpanzee, if in a similar situation, would immediately drown. Its nostrils are so wide, and it has no ability to hold its breath in the water. We have something which is known as a diver's reflex, which no primate has, no other primate has. And the diver's reflex is this. When you dive into the water, not only do you hold your breath, but your heartbeat slows down. And that's in order to adjust the circulation of your circulatory system to extreme change in temperature. No other primate has that. We have something else called sebum, S-E-B-U-M. This is a waxy substance that's produced from the top of our head when we're born. We're born with a kind of a waxy substance. This is waterproofing. The sebum grows to a large extent during the onset of adolescence, and this causes sometimes acne, pimples, and so on when there's an excess of that. This is a waterproofing. When a mother... A woman, she's not a mother yet, a pregnant woman is about to give birth, her scalp becomes much more tough, her hair gets longer and more resilient and stronger, and that is so that when the baby was born, and there are other sea animals like the... not sea mammals entirely, but like the Japanese macaque or the proboscis monkey has the same thing. The proboscis monkey's mother has the same thing. And this is a proboscis monkey is a monkey that lives to a large extent in the water in Madagascar. And when the mother is about to give birth, the hair, especially on the head, gets stronger. That's because the infant then grasps the hair of the mother's head. Then when the human mother's after the human mother has given birth and the child has grown to some extent, then the mother's hair and scalp go back to normal again. There are so many, I mean, I can't even think of them off the top of my head. There's literally dozens of physical qualities that we have that set us apart completely from all other primates, but are similar to other mammals. And one of the most important of all that you touched upon is our attitudes. Sea mammals are known for their playfulness, for their social adaptability, and for their high intelligence. And the reason why they're intelligent is because they are eating seafood. And you've often heard that fish are referred to as brain food, and they are. It's been established that fish do have the fatty acids, especially omega-3, which contributes to brain growth, physical brain growth. So here you have a primate species long ago that is no longer just eating dead animals that have been left over from better predators. We were scavengers. Most monkeys and chimpanzees and gorillas, in fact, are still scavengers. They eat the leftover of what others have done. Our ancestors, going through the aquatic phase, they were now eating shellfish, fish, all kelp. These are all enormously powerful elements in building up the brain, and that coincides perfectly with early Homo erectus, who had also a brain boost. evolutionists have never been able to figure out how we got this brain boost. We did get this brain boost by eating seafood and kelp, which contributed to our development. One more trait, and this is interesting because it has been recently found. It's brand new. Last February, the National Geographic magazine carried a story about why is it that when we put our fingers in water for a long time, our fingers and toes, that they get pruney, that they sort of get really wrinkly if we submerge our fingers for a long time. British scientists have now determined that is an evolutionary trick that our ancestors used. It was part of our aquatic ape phase, because when you have your fingers and toes submerged in water for a long time, they're able to grasp things much better. You can grasp onto rocks. You can grasp onto prey, onto food. It's a technique that was used. The evolution development was used to prune up our fingers so we had a better grasping capability in the water. And what's remarkable about this aquatic ape theory, it certainly is not mine. It goes back a long time, and it is now becoming more and more accepted. Even David Attenborough, who is probably the most famous naturalist in the world today with his Life on Earth series and so forth, has now become an advocate of the aquatic ape theory. So that it explains way too much of our early evolution. I was interested in this. Okay, this is what caused us, but the most important thing is that the aquatic ape theory shows that we have both the elements of the sea mammal, which is generally a kinder creature. It is a predator on a much lower level, because the only thing that the dolphins eat are mackerel and herring and so forth. They eat fish, and whereas the dolphin is a highly cooperative animal. It's a very friendly animal to other species, especially to man. Whereas they don't have these stratified societies. They do have some stratification, but it's very fluid. A lot of friendliness. For example, the dolphins have a midwife, so that when a dolphin gives birth, the older female dolphin will assist in the birth and make sure that the baby dolphin goes to the surface and can take its first breath of air. The chimpanzees, however, it's amazing. The chimpanzees, however, you have amongst themselves a tribal society, highly stratified, regard all outsiders as enemies. They engage in cannibalism. They have wars. You can even see the origins of racism and religious bigotry amongst chimpanzees. One example of that is the chimpanzees. They communicate with each other not with sounds very much. The only sounds they create are for alarms and screams and things like that. But their real communication is with signs and gestures. And one of their gestures is where they take their hands and they like pump them up in the air, and that's a sign of hierarchy, of authority. So if I pump them high up in the air, that means I'm above you socially, and if I pump them down, that means you are beneath me. And they use these symbols, these gestures all the time to show who is higher or lower. And in one instance that was noticed by Jane Goodall, a very famous primatologist, of course, she saw a pack of these chimpanzees out in the savanna, and they were out foraging in the savanna, and there was a big thunderstorm was coming on, and all of a sudden there was an enormous clap of thunder and a great flash of light, lightning in the sky, and all of the chimpanzees began making the gesture for hierarchy towards the sky. In other words, they were acknowledging that there was a superior power above them. Even the leader of the troop made the same gesture upward. But here we see the beginnings of religion, of course, which is God is the supreme power, the supreme authority.
Right.
And now I'm not making that an argument for atheism or anything. I don't want to do that. But I mean, this is something that happened nonetheless. And you see this now transferred, same basic ideas to ourselves. We are similar. We have similarities to them, but we have also great differences. For example, when a chimpanzee mother gives birth, she eats the placenta. That's typical. That's of all the great apes. They eat the placenta. No sea mammals do that. The dolphins and even the otters and the beavers, they do not eat the placenta. That's left. That's always. And we don't. Human beings, so far as I've understood, human beings have never engaged in that. Although we do engage in cannibalism from some time to time. That happens.
I had to just jump in real quickly here. You were discussing the web hand and how Stalin, you had discovered, has this web hand. But what a son of a gun! He's an SOB. Where's the light quality and the gentle quality in his nature? It doesn't seem to be there unless it was as a child and then something happened to him to turn him into this tyrant.
Well, Stalin was just a typical human being. What I mean by this is that he had both the good and the bad in him. In him, it was mostly horrible. He was
horrible.
One of the greatest monsters of all time. But nonetheless, one of his favorite statements was that the death of a single human being is a tragedy, whereas the death of 1,000 human beings is a statistic. And that sums up his mind. In other words, he felt very badly if somebody in his family died. He could cry for the death of of his child or someone close to him. But he could consign millions, literally 20 million. Can you imagine this? 20 million Ukrainians alone died in the great famines that he specifically instituted to punish the kulaks. And for him, that was a statistic. That's all it was.
Yeah.
Just 20.
Yeah.
So people said, well, Marshall Stalin, we've achieved the purging of all of these elements in Ukraine, 20 million. And so, well, that's a good statistic. So
he was a monster.
That's horrible. But in a way, he's typical because he was an extreme example. Because I know in my own life, I have done things, I think, very compassionate things. I've felt very empathetic for other people and for other animals and so on. I've also done cruel things I'm terribly ashamed of. I've done horrible mistakes, you know, and I would like to avoid those, but we are a mix. Just like Goethe noticed this long ago. He said, in his Faust, which is a really interesting story, in Faust, Goethe says, I have in me two souls. One wants to tear away from the other one. And I think that really epitomizes what we are. We are a conflicted species. We're caught between the land and the sea. And that explains a lot. It explains
Amazing.
A lot of what we are.
In the time we have left, talk about a chapter that I found quite fun to read because it brings up some of the latest data. Andrew Collins has just published a book on Göbekli Tepe, where he describes the 12,000-year-old dwelling in a way that no one can talk about because it really isn't any other than the scientific journals and the archaeological excavation reports. There really hasn't been a piece of work yet. But in your chapter called Stone Age Sophistication, you do touch upon Göbekli Tepe and also its potential relation on other sites around the world. Can you tell us a little bit about what you discovered in its relation to Göbekli Tepe? That's a fascinating place.
Well, first of all, I have to say that Andrew Collins has written a true masterpiece on this. I really defer to him on the Göbekli Tepe. He is just the best mind on this incredible site. I think for our listeners to understand what Göbekli Tepe is, they have to get some idea. It's this beautiful, circular, concentric temple that's made up of these great T-squares and has these magnificent bas-relief images of different types of animals, scorpions and so forth. And it's incredibly old. It completely shatters the paradigm. It goes back to, it could be, we don't even know exactly. It's about, right now it's about 12,000 years, about 11 to 12,000 years old. In other words, it was created right at the end of the last ice age. When the last ice age ended, this highly sophisticated, beautiful stone temple found in southern Turkey was made. And it obviously wasn't the first one. I mean, somebody had to make some developments first, and they're made up of multi-ton stones, beautifully. It's sophisticated. It's not crude.
Yeah.
It's actually more sophisticated than Stonehenge, which came much later. And according to mainstream historians, we're told that, oh, nobody did anything in those days except they were like basket weavers and, you know, sheep herders, and that's the extent of it. No, turns out they were builders of great monuments. But the thing, the only original contribution, if it is a contribution that I've made to it, is that I found a real parallel between that place in southern Turkey, Göbekli Tepe, and a place on the opposite side of the world in the eastern Pacific Ocean, more famous, called Easter Island. Incredible.
Hey.
On Easter Island, it's mostly famous for these great, what they're called moai, M-O-A-I, that's the Polynesian word for these great statues. And there's something like about 40 or 50 of them now that have been found. These great moais, they're all basically the same. They're huge, most of them. And there's an orientation in this statuary of these human beings that are portrayed on Easter Island towards the navel, where the hands taper down, they have these long hands, and they taper down right around the navel. And that's because Easter Island, its original name was Rapa Nui. And before that, it was known as Te Pito Te Henawa. That's its original name, Te Pito Te Henawa. And Te Pito Te Henawa in Polynesian means the navel of the world. And here you see these structures with their hands, their elongated fingers and hands around cradling their navel. Well, now we go back to southern Turkey, and we see these great T-shaped columns, and they're anthropomorphic representations of human beings, not the same as the moai, but somewhat vaguely similar. But the important thing is that it shows at Göbekli Tepe these long arms and hands and fingers oriented around the navel. This is not something you see every place in the world. Let me tell you, this is not found really hardly any place at all. Now, that T-square you do find in a couple of places. That unusual T square you find in Mexico, it's a Mexican symbol, the Maya symbol for ek, which means breath, and it's incorporated in some of their architecture. Most commonly, though, you see that great T column, an unusually T shaped, it's called a tau or the capital T. You do find that in some of the great ruins of Polynesia, pre-Polynesian structures that are found in Polynesia. All this goes back to a pre-civilization which is remembered as Mu or Lemuria. Mu and Lemuria are associated with the T. That was written up back in the 19th century by Colonel James Churchward. He defined the symbol of Mu or Lemuria as this great Tau or T, which they associated back then with a constellation in the sky called the Southern Cross. And here you have an Easter Island called Te Pito Te Henawa, the navel of the world. And what is the name of that hill? What does Göbekli Tepe mean? It means the hill navel or the navel hill. So I think that Göbekli Tepe is old and as ancient as it is. And here it's just created without any precursors. It's like brand new, but it obviously had been created by some. There must have been some knowledge that went into it long beforehand. And then you have Easter Island now, and those great moai are dated now back much further than they believe. I believe that both Göbekli Tepe in Turkey and Easter Island in the Eastern Pacific were both children of Mu. I think that when that civilization long ago, we didn't get a chance to talk about Lemuria. Lemuria is much older than Atlantis. I think that when Lemuria suffered its catastrophe, that its survivors went to different parts of the world, and they brought with them their same basic ideas. And the reason why they're not identical, I mean, you wouldn't find Easter Island the same thing in Turkey, in southern Turkey, is because these newcomers from Lemuria, they interacted with the local cultures, and so you're going to see some cultural differences, but the same basic idea is found on both sides of the world, and it points to these much earlier cultures. It might seem to be utterly fantastic to us now and certainly totally rejected by mainstream scholars, but look at Göbekli Tepe. I mean, if you were to propose to a mainstream scholar that there was something as highly advanced as Göbekli Tepe going back 11 or 12,000 years ago, they would say that's utterly impossible, ridiculous, and yet there it is. It's found.
Yeah.
I think the same applies to Lemuria.
That's the challenge with the Göbekli Tepe, is that it is so old and it is sophisticated, even though it doesn't look like it's sophisticated. The more that they uncover and research shows that these are very refined carvings.
I disagree with you. I think it looks very sophisticated, just the layout alone. And now, it's as Andrew Collins has so brilliantly brought out, that what Göbekli Tepe really is an observatory. And it's probably a computer observatory. And that those symbols that we're seeing, like the scorpions and so forth, those are representations of constellations that those T columns were oriented to. I mean, that's remarkable. I mean, that's highly advanced. And here we're going back to the Ice Age. So I believe that our civilization, I mean, as a species, goes back much further than anybody ever imagined. And to talk about Atlantis and Lemuria is by no means radical at all. It's probably even will be seen as conservative. I think that human civilization goes back much further even than Atlantis. I think Atlantis is just the first modern one. We are direct descendants of Atlantis. When Atlantis set the tone or the pattern for civilizations that start out in a very virtuous way, they create a lot of great things, they become self-indulgent, and they kill themselves. And that pattern was set by Atlantis, and we've been undergoing it constantly since then, and now it's our turn. So,
well, that's
no big
the
deal.
Challenge. Why doesn't science look at ancient Vedic history and look at the, according to Vedic history, the mankind's been around millions of years, and yet they refuse to look at that because it's verses rather than historical documents. And so we're kind of left with these eggheads who just don't want to bend to Eastern philosophy as a source for history, which is really frustrating for a lot of us.
Well, I can tell you, I've been in and out of the academic world for decades now, and I know a lot of these mainstream people. And privately, they will agree with you and me entirely, but they don't dare mention it publicly for fear of ridicule from their fellows, from their colleagues. That's the truth. That's the main thing. There is such professional jealousy that they will not admit these things. I'm not saying that they're all this way, but I would say most archaeologists, anthropologists, privately, they are very open to these things. And some of them are as much believers, but they know that their tenor, where the university is really going to be, is going to be endangered if they are going to be presenting ideas that are not politically correct.
Well, I agree.
That's the world we live in.
Robert Schock, in his new book, Forgotten Civilization, actually has a chapter on the stigma and the sludge of orthodox science. And his belief is, and he states it quite clearly, that these people have to die, pass away, for the new blood to come through and say, look, we're going to look at this, and we're going to actually begin documenting some of this research. And if it shifts the history, so be it. But it may take, you know, some significant deaths to be passed before these things come to be, you know. So,
well, you know, it's been said, you know, that science advances with the death of one scientist at a time, and
that's sad though.
And that's true, because if you look at the history of science, what is the history of science? The history of science is where some courageous individual will stand up and say, "Hey, guess what? The sun does not go around the earth. The earth goes around the sun." And what happens, of course, is that person is killed or put in jail for the rest of their lives. But and then years later, they decide, oh, yeah, remember that guy that we killed or we put in the slammer for all that time? Well, turns out he was right after all. That is the whole history of science. And the reason why it's the history of science, there's nothing wrong with science. It's human beings. It's human nature. I mean, we were even talking about these megaliths and so forth. The great caves that the megalith builders painted, everybody's familiar with this fabulous art, like Lascaux and Trafaire, these magnificent paintings that the cave builders, artists did more than 15,000 to 40,000 years ago. You know when those caves were first found? Academia said they're all fake. Somebody came in and just tried to fool us, tried to make us look silly. They're all fake. It was decades after those caves were first found that the first men that found them, they said, you know, this is great cave art. No, no. After those men had long passed away, then they finally recognized, oh, I guess they're real caves art after all. That's just as the way it goes. That's just the way it goes. People think that science is this wonderful, continuous progression of ideas and so on. They live in a fantasy world. That's not the real world at all.
Well, I've been questioning a lot of the research. For me, it's the Maya, and they are depicted as loincloth wearing savages, and they did have a savage period. The final stages of their evolution, they had de-evolved to a savage level. But when you go down to Yucatan and Central America, and you see these ruins, you know that the mathematics, the geometry, the archaeology, or the architectural design is all behind, that's a genius level of people.
It's a brilliant mind behind it.
Yeah.
But the Maya really typify everything we've talked about because they did magnificent things. There's no doubt. Like you said, the mathematics alone, the applied mathematics alone is enough to qualify them as a genius people. And yet they were involved in ritual cannibalism. And it wasn't during a period of decline. That's what I used to think, too. Oh, well, they only do this when they decline. No, they were always that way. They sacrificed people from the beginning of their – all Mesoamerican peoples were involved in eviscerating the heart while it – a person was alive. The most accurate representation of a human heart in art was done by the Maya. This was long before the beginning of modern anatomy, back about in the 17th or 16th century. And it was found, I think it goes back to about 700 or 600 AD. It's a representation of a human heart that was found in Yucatan. And the reason why the Maya had such an excellent idea of a human heart is because they took out so many. And they were involved. It used to be believed that the Maya were these peaceful people that just were interested in the arts and sciences, and they lived in these sort of idyllic jungle cities. And so, well, that's not the case at all. It turns out now, because we can translate their hieroglyphs exactly, we can read everything they have to say, and there's a lot of nasty stuff going on. A lot of nasty stuff.
Yeah,
where these city states. Oh, yeah, these city-states would rival each other. And, of course, even the Aztecs were even worse later on. And the Aztecs were the direct inheritors of the Maya, the whole Mesoamerican tradition. And the Aztecs would wage war on a different people, regional people, exclusively so they could put on their festivals. And at one of their festivals, 20,000 people had their heart ripped out. So, and then the body was thrown down the side of one of the pyramids, and was the reason why they did that was to tenderize the body, and it was thrown into a big stew pot, and then they would all have this great cannibal feast. So, and yet the Aztecs also created floating gardens, you know, and beautiful pyramids, and there were great artists, and all. And that's what we are. That's what we are. You know, and people say, oh, we're not like Aztecs. We don't do that. No? Well, how about waterboarding? And how about the napalm we drop and the atom bombs and all this other stuff? Oh, no, we don't do stuff like that, you know. No. No,
we're going to have you back again. We're going to have you back. We've been speaking with Frank Joseph. The book is Before Atlantis, 20 Million Years of Human and Prehuman Cultures. We just have a few more minutes. Tell us, where are you going to be, Frank, in this summer? We're in the summer now. We're a couple of days from the summer solstice, so do you have a list of events that you're going to be speaking in this summer and fall that you can tell us about?
Well, I've got really one coming up I would really urge people to attend, and that is I'm going to be at the largest pyramid in North America. It's called Monk's Mound in Cahokia, It's called Cahokia, and it's in Collinsville, Illinois. It's right across the Mississippi River from St. Louis. I'm going to be speaking there at this huge pyramid that was made over 1,000 years ago by an unknown people. It's part of an archaeological park, major archaeological park, and that will be August 16th. And
okay.
I'll be talking there with a number of other presenters, and we're going to be speaking about Monks Mound in Cahokia, this great city of over 30,000 people that flourished there more than 1,000 years ago. And this is in south-central western Illinois. Like I said, it's right across from St. Louis. And anybody that's interested in that, they can contact me at a toll-free number. It's 877-494-0044. And that's toll-free,
okay.
And it's 24 hours a day.
Okay. And do you have a website you can give us web address to?
www.ancientamerican.com.
Okay, ancient. Okay, great. And then the last thing is, where can we get the book? Where would you suggest we download and get the newest book before Atlantis?
Well, they can get Atlantis by either calling that phone number I gave you, 877-494-0044. They can take all kinds of credit cards and stuff, or they can go to that website that I mentioned. It's www.ancientamerican.com. And if the book is not shown, sometimes our website changes around. If it's not there, they can just contact Ancient American at that website, ancientamerican.com, and ask for Before Atlantis, and we'll get them a copy.
Fantastic. I would love to have you on again, and just to focus maybe on Atlantis and Lemuria. Sounds like you wrote
sure.
a book on Lemuria, too.
Yeah,
so,
I did.
So let's consider that in the fall, and thank you very much. Enjoyed your talk, and we will have you on again. So
thank well,
thank
you,
you
much, Cliff, for your really intelligent conversation. I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks, Frank. So that's it for this week. We will see you next time. Next week we have a fantastic speaker on the ice-covered Atlantis. Thanks. We'll see you.